Thank you very much. Just want to acknowledge my colleagues, Mark and Aaron at Stony Brook, as well as Pat now at Utah, and Ray and Joe at Harvard. Let's see here. Is this this? And of course, to thank Kurt and the Brainchild Foundation and Siv and Jim and Pino for this wonderful, and the Fields Institute for this wonderful opportunity. Just to review briefly some of the stuff about pulse theory that we've been talking about, is that I believe that there is considerable evidence that abnormalities of pulse motility play an important role in hydrocephalus. In 1964, Behring did a series of experiments in which he removed the choroid plexus from one lateral ventricle in dogs and then induced Kaolin hydrocephalus by injection into the subarachnoid space. And the ventricle on the side in which the choroid plexus was removed did not dilate. He did sham experiments where he showed that it wasn't simply the entrance into the ventricle and the change in elastin to the ventricular wall, the surgical artifact, that caused it. And he did experiments in which he opened the septum pellucidum, and he found that right across from the opening of the septum pellucidum, the ventricle without the choroid plexus did in fact have a little region of enlargement, as if something was being transferred between them. And again, we point out that this fluid system was in continuity. There were no obstructions within the ventricular system itself. He measured the pulse pressure in the ventricles and found that the pulse pressure in the ventricle that didn't dilate, the one without the choroid plexus, was much lower than the pulse pressure in the one that did. Wilson and Bertan extended Behring's work by not even going into the ventricles. They simply occluded the anterior choroidal artery on one side of the dog. They just clamped it. Then they gave the dog hydrocephalus, just like Behring did. And just as Behring found, the ventricle that had the clamped anterior choroidal artery didn't dilate. So they felt that was pretty good evidence that it was the pulsatility in the choroid plexus that was the proximate cause of the ventricular dilation. DeRocco tried to induce ventricular dilation just by putting little balloons in the lateral ventricles of sheep, little tiny balloons that were attached to a pump that expanded the balloon in synchrony with the sheep's heartbeat. And over several days, he could get considerable ventricular dilation with just balloons with no obstruction whatsoever to CSF resorption. It's not an absorptive phenomenon. And pathologically, the walls of the ventricles in the sheep were indistinguishable from those that are found in human communicating hydrocephalus. Guinane then found that if he took rabbits and around their olfactory lobes and the olfactory ventricles that are in the lobes, if he occluded the subarachnoid space of the olfactory lobe, actually right here, but didn't do anything to the ventricle and limited this occlusion of the subarachnoid space just to that one little region, he got ventricular dilation right where he occluded the subarachnoid space and nowhere else. So we assumed it was a transmantle pulse pressure gradient that was ultimately leading to that finding. And there have been a ton of experiments that have shown marked abnormalities of pulsatility, or marked changes in pulsatility, associated with hydrocephalus. So I believe that there is reason to think that pulsatility may be important in hydrocephalus. The question is, how can we best understand it using techniques of mathematical modeling? The most mathematical models that we use are based on the Monroe-Kelly model, which, as has been pointed out many times, is a model of mass conservation. It's cows in and cows out. The Monroe-Kelly model is very nicely suited to describe relatively smooth convective dynamics. The problem is that virtually all of the motion in the CSF is pulsatile, and that's not to imply that the Monroe-Kelly model can't describe pulsatile motion, but that oscillations inherently involve phenomena. For example, impedance, reactance, phase, all these sorts of things that are described with terms that are different from those that conventionally come out of convective models. That is, all models are in some sense degenerate from the system that they describe. No model is the same as the system. If it were, it would be the system. But every degenerate model eliminates some part of the dynamics and obscures another part of the dynamics. I propose that our models that are based on Monroe-Kelly dynamics obscure oscillatory phenomena. There is no impedance in these models. There's no reactance. There's no phase that falls out of the model as an important part of the dynamics. Of course, using models that do highlight those then obscure other things. In addition, I propose that in order to understand intracranial pulsatility with modeling, we must understand that there are things about intracranial pulsatility that call for a radical change in the way we think about pulsatility inside the cranium. That is, that there are very odd things going on inside the cranium. The physical things, not just mental things. The ICP pulse pressure amplitude and the low ICP anomaly was observed by Fultz and Sklar in the mid-1980s. What they did is they took experimental dogs and they varied the mean CSF pressure by the lumbar infusion or withdrawal of CSF. And they measured the CSF pulse pressure in the cranium based on the mean CSF pressure. This is the normal range. This is the Fultz's work and Sklar's work. This is the normal range. These are the error bars. And the pulse pressure, of course, as you raise the ICP, goes up. By Monroe Kelly reasoning, by the reasoning we've all grown up with and lived with, if you withdraw CSF, the pulse pressure ought to go down. If it's a pressure volume phenomenon and you're removing volume, you're going to have a lower change in pressure. They found the pulse pressure went up when you lowered CSF pressure, just like it goes up when you raise CSF pressure. It's a thought. It's a thought. I mean, there may be other explanations. They were at a loss. I mean, Fultz felt that there was a venous dilation that went on accompanying this. It's an ad hoc thing, but the point is, it didn't react the way we think it would react. Now, removing CSF from the cranium unequivocally lowers intracranial elastins and raises intracranial compliance. There's no question about that. Every day, thousands of operating rooms use that technique to make the brain softer to retract it. We put lumbar drains in, we suck out CSF, the brain falls away. It's a more compliant system. Yet, in a more compliant system, they found a higher pulse pressure. Sklar found the same thing. The fascinating thing about this, as if this is not fascinating enough alone, is that when Fultz gave the dogs hydrocephalus, this U-shaped response disappeared. It was the expected linear response. He took the mean pressure of the dog when he removed CSF and lowered the mean pressure, the pulse pressure went down. So this U-shaped phenomenon he found is characteristic of normal animals, not of hydrocephalic animals. What's even stranger was an observation by Nida in Japan in the mid-1980s. Nida measured the transmission delay between the carotid arterial pulse and the intracranial pressure pulse. Actually, he measured the epidural pulse, but assumed it to be equivalent to the intracranial pressure pulse. The point was, he wanted to show, could you say something about brain compliance or about mean ICP based on the delay between the time the pressure pulse arrives in the carotid artery and the time it reaches the brain? So he measured it. He found, indeed, as he injected, as he expanded an intracranial balloon, which raised the ICP, the timing changed in the difference between the carotid pulse and the epidural pulse. And the timing changed looked like this. We found that, in a sense, the epidural pulse happened later and later in the cardiac cycle with raising of ICP. The bizarre thing was this. All these numbers are negative. And he didn't comment on it. But it says data. In every single animal, the ICP pulse preceded the carotid arterial pulse. Every animal. So the changes were all relative. The ICP pulse happened before the pulse in the carotid artery that supposedly gave rise to it. There are very odd things happening in pulsatility in the cranium if we look carefully at what people have found, and it calls for a reevaluation of the way we understand pulsatility. If pulsatility matters in hydrocephalus, and I think there's reason to think it might, we have to first step back and say, how well do we understand pulsatility? There's reasons to think that we don't understand it very well. So we took 12 dogs, and our purpose was to replicate the experiments of Nida and of Fultz and Sklar. So we put an intracranial pressure monitor in the brain, we put a pressure monitor in the carotid artery, we also measured venous pressure, which we won't get into here, we're still sort of analyzing that. We varied the ICP by lumbar and occasionally by cisternal, if we couldn't get enough fluid out of the lumbar region, injection and withdrawal of CSF, and then we analyzed the amplitude and phase of the vascular pulses and the ICP pulses. Our amplitude results trended in a way that would support Fultz and Sklar. Ours weren't so clean. That is, that we found there are times at low ICP. This is the adjusted mean ICP, meaning we started wherever the animal started was zero, and this is 10 below and 10 above. And we did find that there's a trend in some animals to go up. It wasn't as clean as Fultz and Sklar. So those results were consistent with, but not as tight as we would have liked. By the way, it's very difficult, I don't know if you had the same experience, we found it very hard to get CSF out of the lumbar space of a dog. We really, you're socking the calf of the blocks, and we had to go to the cisterna magna, but that's a difficult place to be too. So technically it was awfully difficult. The phase data is a bit tighter and quite interesting. At low ICP, this is low to normal ICP, here's the ICP waveform, and here's the arterial waveform, and these are the normalized pressures, we can compare them. The blue is the ICP, and the red is the arterial waveform. In normal ICP in these dogs, the ICP pulse happens before the carotid arterial pulse. Oh, sure. One thought would be that there's a shift that's near the entire cycle.
Clearly, but that has to be a result of the arterial pulse.
Right. Well, that's the interesting question. That's the question we want to raise, is can this be understood in any other way except is it almost a complete cardiac cycle shift, or is there some other artery bringing the blood in so there's a local phase difference in these animals? For example, we're measuring carotid, perhaps this part of the brain is being irrigated by the basal, which has a phase lead. I mean, those questions are real. But at least for first sight, we're measuring the carotid, we're measuring the ICP, and ICP comes first. It leads us to ask questions. It's a standing wave, and it's being excited by an external wave, but it resonates itself in its own chamber, and it can have leading arising phase shift with regard to instant waves.
So how would it lead? How would it lead on that based on that?
If you have inertial reactance that exceeds elastic reactance. And again, this is why we need your help, because we put together what is admittedly a fairly crude understanding of this, but we're trying to understand fairly shocking data that we can't find another way around that makes sense.
We measure volumetric flow rate.
Mm-hmm.
We never found that if the volume and pressure are correlated, we should expect the peak of the volumetric flow rate,
sure,
the CSF, to precede the
bacteria. It happens all the time in syringes. It happens all the time in syringes. Bradley found that there's a quarter phase lead. Yeah, it's the craniospinal space. It's all in continuity. Well, put the syringe up there. My point is not so much that. Well, actually, you can get a hydrobulbia, but my point is that there are intracranial situations where the flow leads, but we have not measured flow; we've just measured pressure. And what I was hoping to save time is we'll avoid the difficult questions.
But there is a real issue here
with where we can't believe this data. Oh yeah, sure. Absolutely, or how we interpret it, just what is this data telling us. What we found was, and I believe this is part of what mitigates against the notion that it's simply a 2-pi phase lag, is that when we elevated the ICP, we found that there was a change in the phase, and in fact that the ICP either became synchronous with the arterial pulse, or slightly lagged it in places. So there was this predictable change between these two pulses. Doesn't mean it couldn't be a 2-pi lag. Oh, no, I'll show you. This is, yes.
If you look at your upper normalized pressure,
yeah,
and look at the very bottom,
uh-huh,
it's not really anywhere near a 2-pi change, but you could definitely look at the arterial pulse rise is very rapid.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so when it gets to the top, it looks like it's very far before the next two
pulse.
But on the bottom, it doesn't, because the CSF pressure rises much more slowly because you don't have a tight system.
Precisely.
And it's probably the exactly what you say. The red one, the earlier red one goes with the later blue one, and then they get closer on the bottom, when now the CSF pressure rises very fast.
Well, I should point out, and maybe Mark can help me on this a little bit, we occasionally have skip beats. that occur with the dogs, which of course would be a direct answer to that point. And Mark, if I'm going to put you on the spot, but my impression of the skip beats, there are only a few of them, don't support the notion that it's a two-pi phase lag, right? Correct? Yes. Mark is trying to equivocate here. He says, yes. Yeah. Anecdotally, we don't see the SCP showing up a cycle later on Skippy.
There is no phase lag in humans.
No, and slow.
There's always a phase lag. It's always never does the CSF alter the inverse happen. Never does the CSF lead out before you get flow.
On flow?
Depends on how you interpret that graph.
Right.
No.
Oh, in MRI in humans.
No, I'm sorry. In humans, if you saw that, you'd just say, well,
right. Well, that's I'm on the next slide. Let me just. That's all done here. Sure. Okay. No, that's okay. Now, these are very good questions and questions that we've been struggling with. So what we did was we took the animals, and we're still in the process of going over this. Although of all the different ways, of all the different things we're measuring, this is the stuff that's turning out to be sort of the most reproducible. And that is when you have a waveforms that are the same frequency but a different morphology, you're going to ask the question, well, what does phase mean? Phase, what's your reference? So there are all sorts of ways of talking about phase. We can talk about phase in terms of the peak of the wave. When we talk about phase in terms of the mean crossing, that is, at each cardiac cycle, there's a mean ICP at that cycle, or a mean blood pressure. And when the waveform crosses that mean, we recorded that and compared the timing. We also looked at centroid. And what centroid was the half area point in the systolic upstroke of the waveform, filling that sort of the half power point. It's where a half of systole has happened in that wave. And we think that might help us clear up issues of morphology. So half the oomph of the wave has occurred at that point, and that's the phase reference. We've also looked at just upstroke, very first upstroke, first time the wave went from doing this to doing that. And we looked at the phase of the fundamental of the FFT. And these are the various ways of measuring in a single dog. And what we found was that they're all similar graphs. So what we're actually now, Mark, I think, using first upstroke, I believe, because that sort of seems to be the most reasonable. And what we found here was that at the normal ICP of the dog, that these negative numbers mean the ICP leads, positive means it lags with respect to the carotid arterial pulse. In every way we could find of measuring phase, we got about the same result. ICP leads at normal and low, ICP lags, and only lags by a little at high. And again, the notion that it could be a two-cycle, a two-pi change, this looks like a consistent bunch of data. We think these things are linked, and in the few cases where we've seen an asystole in the cardiac tracing, we don't see a little less than a cycle later an ICPB. Well, but the thing is that there's a rebound, and actually when you're measuring the ICP pulse, you're measuring the combination of the force generated by the arterial pulse and the force generated by the elastic rebound of the cranial contents. It's a balance of forces. But let me, a lot of questions may be answered as I go on. Well, we think it's the fundamental wave. Well, it's the craniospinal axis. Yeah, it's a standard wave. It's, you know, it goes down and systole and up and diastole. It's right. It's a very interesting question. I don't know. What we then looked at next, which we were hoping to sort of tie this stuff together, but maybe it does, is the transfer function. Of course, most folks should be quite comfortable with this, but the transfer function is a way of analyzing how a system transfers an input to an output in the frequency domain. Looks how each individual frequency is processed in terms of gain and in terms of phase. And this is work that has been done by our colleagues Joe Madsen and Ray Zhu at Harvard using an ARMA analysis, which is a computational analysis that I don't understand very well, but it's beautiful. And what they've done is they've taken our data and actually have also used data from some other teams and looked at the transfer function. So this is a graph of the transfer function of this animal. This is the ICP. This is normal. These ICP spikes are just sort of, this animal's just laying there asleep on the operating table. And this is the arterial blood pressure pulsatility in these animals. And this is the transfer function of this to this. And this axis is the frequency. This axis is the time of the experiment. And the gain coming out of the board at us, indicated by colors, is the amplitude of the transfer function. What we notice is that at the heart rate of the dog, one has a notch that goes wrong in the transfer function. What that notch implies is that this dog's cranium is suppressing the fundamental frequency of input of the heartbeat. It is, in a sense, a band stop filter, or notch filter, which is commonly seen in electronics and all sorts of things. And what we then find, and again, these are sort of anecdotal. We've not had a chance to go over all the animals and look at them all, but certainly many of them show this. What we then find is that, and this is again Jay and Ray's work, is that when we inject CSF into the lumbar space and have a spike in ICP, the ICP then comes down normal. This is the arterial blood pressure. This is the transfer function of this. This is frequency, this is time, and out of the board is the gain. And we see that the notch that's normally present before we inject the CSF goes away with the CSF injection, and then is restored as the ICP comes down. It seems that the notch is in some way dependent on normal intracranial dynamics and is ablated by elevation of ICP by CSF injection. So the suppression of the incoming arterial pulse at the fundamental of the pulse, which is where most of the energy of the pulse is, seems to be the normal state of dynamics, and disrupting that state causes a release of suppression.
What happens if you increase the heart rate?
Haven't done that yet. It's a very interesting thing and a very important thing. No, I'm sorry. If you increase your anecdotally, the notch follows the heart rate. Joe, is that?
Well,
unless it's auto regulated.
Sure. You can take the Laplace transform of the whole thing and work out the transfer function exactly.
Mm-hmm.
How does that
nutrient? No, we haven't, and that's why we need you. Desperately need you. Okay. Because all the mathematical sophistication is not nearly what it needs to be. So that's why we're happy to be here. So the way I look at this is very crude, but trying to put this together, I realize it's a very hard thing to accept conceptually. That an ICP waveform can lead the arterial waveform that supposedly leads to it, and then where does this notch come into it, and why does the amplitude at low ICP of the pulse pressure go up instead of go down? I think of it as a violin analogy. I propose that the ICP pulse is a standing wave in the cranium. It's not a transmitted wave. It's not a sound wave going just through the air, where, of course, the vibration of my vocal cord must precede the vibration in the air five feet away from me. It has to. It comes from the heart, but the cranium is like the body of a violin. The oscillations inside are excited by bowing of the string, but they're not just the simple transmission of the wave through the violin. There's a much more complex dynamic going on inside the cranium, and the forces acting on the cranium involve the walls of the chamber and all sorts of other things besides simply this transmitted wave. It's not just a light beam. It's oscillating inside a chamber, and you can get leading and lagging. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you do a transfer function analysis of vibrations in the string of the violin and vibrations in the body of the violin, you'll find that for each frequency of oscillation inside the violin, each mode of oscillation, there will be a particular amplitude, a particular gain to the transfer function, and a particular phase. And it need not be positive. It can be negative.
But I tend to think of the arterial pulse as the bell.
Well, it's the vibration of the bell.
Yeah.
Right.
So in a sense, I find it conceptually difficult to think of the wave induced in the violin as preceding the input.
Certainly in the startup, in the transient. But once you reach a steady state, need that be the case? That's my question. Is the phase restricted must the phase always be with the violin oscillation lagging? Can it lead in the steady state?
So this would not happen with a single wave.
Correct, correct. This is a steady state standing wave excitation. Nothing to do with transients.
You know, I think you got it like
it. Yeah, sure.
No. Like, no, look at work done on chicks in the 60s, 70s, where people measure arterial pressure and ICP simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
They get a lot of variability of condition, elevated ICP, low ICP. I don't remember seeing
the right.
Well, I don't know if
it is between cats and dogs. There are differences. There are differences, but I think that my suspicion is that it probably has been measured that carefully. For example, Neva measured it, and didn't even mention it. It was in his data, and he made no mention of it at all.
Are you sure that his minus is not a definition issue?
Well, that's why we did, I don't think so, that's why we did our thing. And we found that it was that was present, was real. So our notion here is that an external source excites standing waves in the chamber, but the standing waves, once you're in a steady state, can really lag depending on the elastance and other properties of the chamber. So the way we explain phase is that the phase that we're actually measuring inside the cranium isn't really phase, the physiologically important aspect of phase isn't phase related to the carotid artery. We think of it as impedance phase. That is, phase related to the flow locally where the pressure is being measured. The flow meaning the movement of the tissue or blood. And that this really is just the impedance phase of the effort to flow impedance. The reference phaser is the waveform of blood flow going systole and diastole. The carotid arterial pulse simply tracks systole and diastole for us. At high elastance, the ICP lags the local flow. At low elastance, it leaves the local flow, neither of which have been measured. But we're just assuming it follows systole and diastole. This qualitatively explains the Lever lag, not quantitatively, but qualitatively. And this is just analogous to the phase of voltage versus current in an RLC circuit. You make the system tighter, and the current will lag. You make it, you get less compliance it lags, more compliance it leads. We also, the amplitude of the ICP, this odd phenomenon, we see as a high impedance resonance at the fundamental of the heart rate, at the heart rate itself. In other words, that's kind of an anti-resonance. It's not a low impedance resonance, it's a high impedance resonance. It suppresses pulsatility. This, we think, has to be tuned. Because obviously heart rate changes, this is extremely frequency dependent, so we think the cranial cavity has to in some way actively mediate this phenomenon, and a detuned notch is when you get low and high ICPs and you start getting a higher amplitude. And that's the physiological meaning of this. If this system exists, I agree, this is out there on a limb. If this system exists, what's it doing? Why is it there? And our proposal is that this is the wind tesla mechanism inside the cranium, and or is part of it. That a resonating chamber, such as the cranium, will inherently suppress certain frequencies of input. Every chamber does that. Every chamber is a cavity resonator. Every chamber is a band stop filter for some frequency. There is evidence that the cranium does in fact suppress a frequency, and it turns out to be the frequency of the heartbeat. We think the suppression may protect the microvasculature, part of the wind kessel. Phase determines the frequency of the notch. That is, where the notch is anti-resonance, which is the phase between the effort variable and the flow variable, which is zero at that point. We haven't measured the flow variable. It's awfully hard to measure it in that one area where the catheter is, but we think that that's the relevance of phase. Phase is where the notch is, and that phase is zero. The high impedance wind kessel reflects the cardiac pulse around the microcirculation to the veins. That is, that what this high impedance does is it takes the arterial pulse, diverts it to the veins, so the microcirculation does not get arterial pulsatility. At the same time, the veins get pumped. This is the venous volume venting phenomenon that Foltz noted, and it's the reason that intracranial veins have arterial waveforms, because they're being pumped by the arteries. And the reason they're being pumped by the arteries is because the wind kessel deflects the arterial pulse to the veins. It pumps them. We believe this maximizes blood flow by transforming the pulsatile arterial flow to smooth capillary flow, and does it in a way that pumps the veins and maintains smooth flow. And this has to be tuned. to be altered by heart rate, inertia, compliance, and damping. It has to be autoregulatory tuned. We think that CSF, now how does this apply to hydrocephalus? We think that CSF links different parts of the cranial cavity and it solves mechanical problems that are associated with geometry in a tuned notch filter. That is, it's a hydraulic linkage. So the workflow, ICP, and capillary integrity depend on the integrity of this notch. Hydrocephalus disturbs the dynamics by changing the CSF pathway impedance, which changes the notch. The notch depends on the impedance. In hydrocephalus, CSF pulsations are unevenly distributed, at least in communicating hydrocephalus. This asymmetrical breakdown causes a redistribution of pulsatility that we believe dilates the ventricles. The mechanism by which this occurs is mysterious to us, and a lot of this discussion has been how mysterious that is. We also think that the increase in venous pressure, which of course has to be associated with an increase in capillary pressure, may be in part due to the impairment of the pumping effect of this notch filter, with venous stasis and high venous pressures. So ventricular syndrome can be modeled now as a narrow notch with an excessively high Q factor. These kinds of dynamics are present in radios. They're part of ordinary AC circuits. If you have an AC circuit that has a very high ratio of reactance to resistance in its impedance, you get a very narrow notch, and this system is highly intolerant to perturbation, which is a slit ventricular syndrome by analogy. The notch filter model suggests that therapeutic alterations of intracranial compliance or even heart rate may be of some value in improving intracranial dynamics in hydrocephalus.